Hey, Lincoln, the $64,000 question hasn't changed from week to week. I've got to ask it again. What are the chances we're going to have football?
All this talk of these schools wanting to bring players back on June 1st is one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard. And so we got to be patient. We'll get one good shot at it to bring them back at the right time when we're as prepared and know as much about this as we possibly can.
That was Oklahoma head football coach Lincoln Riley at a virtual press conference, blasting the idea that college football teams can hit the field in just a couple of weeks. As the professional sports leagues begin to work towards a return, college football, with its many provinces and amateur workforce, is still mired in uncertainty. Today, Paul Feinbaum explains where things stand with the different conferences and what has to happen for a season to happen at all. I'm Mina Kimes. It's Tuesday, May 19th. This is ESPN Daily, presented by Marathon.
Can't wait to hear about how my Washington Huskies are going to be screwed for the next 10 years.
Maybe just 4 or 5.
4 or 5. It's no different from how things have been.
Paul Feinbaum has covered college sports for decades and is the host of the Paul Feinbaum Show on ESPN Radio.
So, Paul, we have been talking about how MLB, NBA, NHL might come back, and the college football season seems a ways off, but those conversations are already happening, too. How it might happen, whether it might happen, whether it should happen. Now, I wanted to ask, in your conversations, what is the prevailing mood amongst the people you've spoken with, players, coaches, higher-ups? Are they optimistic about having a college football season in 2020?
The conversation on college football is literally like watching the tape at the New York Stock Exchange. It goes sky high one day, it doesn't move the next, it drops the next, it comes back. And this has been the entire topic of conversation for people in my area for really 9 weeks now. There isn't a commissioner of college football like the NFL or the NHL or the NBA or MLB. You have all these fiefdoms, and then you have the president of the NCAA, who presumably is in charge, but guess what? He's not. He has no actual authority over college football per se. Now, before I go off and turn this into a 45-minute discourse, everyone says they're optimistic. To say anything else would draw wrath from fans who feel like there shouldn't be an issue, but it is very complicated. I think it's the biggest challenge that college football has ever had.
It's complicated for a couple of reasons. One, as you mentioned, jurisdiction. Who actually gets to make these decisions? It's so varied, unlike the professional leagues. And also unlike the professional leagues, we are not talking about professional athletes.
No. And, you know, you may or may not, we'll find out pretty soon, you know, get a number of NBA or MLB or NFL players to sign something saying a waiver of, but you can't do that with college football. And another thing that I think could complicate this as we get a little bit farther along, you mentioned jurisdiction, but what you hear up and down the news channel, whether it's to the right or to the left, you have the same issues in college athletics because governors of various states will end up determining when players can come back or not come back, depending on where they are. And they may also play a role in the upcoming season. So you've already seen a different view from the West Coast than you have in the Deep South. There's more of a readiness to get back to work and of course, to play college football. And their pockets of the East Coast. You have leagues like the ACC, which go from as far south as Miami to as far north as Boston. So there are going to be far more complications with a league like that. It's intriguing and unsettling at times, but of all the uncertainty that involves sports in this pandemic, it still has the greatest unknown.
So what would happen if, say, the SEC schools are all on the same page and they want to bring back college football, and they're in states where that can happen. But say the Pac-12, I'm in California, there's, I think, a longer timeline for reopening here if the Pac-12 doesn't.
Well, it's interesting because on week one of the season, you have a couple of matchups, one in particular between Alabama and Southern Cal, slated for Dallas, that already has seen the athletic directors at Alabama and TCU have private conversations. The reason I bring TCU up is because their first game is at Berkeley, and there is a high degree of suspicion that that game will take place. The one that everyone is wondering about and questioning is the Pac-12. They almost seem to be in a different country than those in the South or in the Midwest.
Paul, if it looks like there's not going to be any Pac-12 football and the players for those schools still want to play, could they potentially transfer?
It's possible. That may be one of the most interesting questions. If the decision is made fairly early that the Pac-12 is not going to play and the NCAA rules that, yes, they could transfer without penalty, it will be it will be the great gold rush in reverse. Instead of going east to west, it will be west to east. And I would think the top players out there would bail immediately. And that's a great concern. There's a lot at stake. The Pac-12 is already challenged. It has made very few appearances in the college football playoff. And it seems like every year there's that team. This year it was Oregon or Utah that comes very close and fails at the end. Larry Scott, who's the commissioner of the Pac-12, has the single biggest challenge, because if the Pac-12 can't play on the same level as everyone else this year, or either plays a limited schedule or no schedule, it's hard to imagine this conference being relevant in any time in the near future.
One of the Pac-12 head coaches, Herm Edwards, said on Get Up a few weeks ago that, you know, it'd be hard to ask players to come back if campuses aren't even open.
The last time I checked, this football game, this football thing, it's not a social distancing sport. And with that being said, if there's no students on campus, you're sending a signal that you feel it's not quite safe for them to return to campus. Well, if that's the case, why is it safe for the players to play football then?
Do you think other colleges around the country harbor those concerns? I mean, what would happen, you know, if school doesn't even open up in Alabama or Mississippi?
It's interesting because we're entering, I think this week will mark 9 weeks into this, into the no sports. And I would say for the first 5 or 6 weeks, I mean, every single person sung from the same hymnal. We can't have college football if students aren't on campus. Suddenly, that has changed. As we get closer to critical dates, you're hearing, well, some football is better than no football. Maybe if we could just have some students on campus, what they're trying to say there is, like the football players, it would at least be open. And I've asked many, many people why. Publicly, they put on a good face. Privately, they're saying, if we don't have college football, some of our athletic departments are going to go under. And there won't be any recovery. We all know everyone has been hurt across the board in every walk of life. But athletics is part of that, because without the NCAA basketball money, without the ability to raise money this time of the year, without putting tuition fees, especially tickets to games, the idea of a sold-out stadium is infinitesimal right now. These athletic departments are under serious challenge.
How does the NCAA feel about that? Because obviously it does kind of detonate the idea that, you know, football players are the same type of students as others.
Well, at the same time that the NCAA is saying we are going to move forward with the idea of maybe September of 21 to allow young athletes to profit from their name, image, and likeness, essentially we're going to ask players to come on campus and provide entertainment for us, as well as keeping our athletic departments afloat by giving us a product and get nothing in return. It's an existential threat to the game of college football and to college athletics. I talked to a former commissioner the other day, Roy Kramer, who was at one time the SEC commissioner, and he said if there's no college football, some of these programs couldn't come back. They may have to take a year off. It could be that dark.
All right, after the break, let's talk about what it would actually look like if the season happens. So, Paul, as we've been discussing, it's unclear if college football is going to happen. It's unclear to what degree it might happen, whether some programs might come back, some conferences, some might not. What are some of the precautions being discussed from a public health and safety perspective?
Well, I think they mirror what you're hearing from everyone else, especially the NFL. I've had several people in college football, commissioners of that like, who are studying what Roger Goodell is doing. They even had a conference call the other day. And I think you will see a lot of protocols, testing perhaps being number one. The issue, though, is in the NFL, you'll have 32 teams. There will be a protocol. There will be a check and balance. How do you do that in college football? I talked to someone involved in the sport the other day that raised this, and I at first I was shocked. He said, how long have you been covering college football? I said, okay, I'm not shocked. And what he said was this. He said, let's say we're in a critical moment of the season and the compliance person or the medical person in charge of testing, you know, goes to a prominent head coach the night before a game and says, so-and-so tested positive. He asked me, do you think that will be dealt with? I mean, do you think the person would immediately be quarantined? Do you think other people that he has come in contact with, which would pretty much be the entire team? And I said, of course. And he said, don't be so sure. I'm not trying to throw things into the fire that don't need to be thrown in, but how are you going to check on that? These are 17 to 22-year-olds. You don't have total control. They're not going to be locked up. And Mina, college football is not an equal sport. What Alabama can do, another school cannot, from a financial standpoint. And I see a lot of serious questions, and I think it could cause some programs not to be able to participate. And we haven't even talked about what stadiums are going to look like, with fans, without fans. I mean, it's one thing to have a NASCAR event with no fans. It's another thing to have the Ohio State-Michigan game with people sitting 6 or 8 feet apart, and who's going to monitor that?
We've been talking about it from the perspective of schools and conferences and, you know, how it'll affect them and, of course, us, you know, fans and analysts. But what about the players? You know, what are you hearing on that front from the actual athletes who are already parts of these teams or have committed to join them, you know, as freshmen? How do they regard all of this?
I think the majority, you know, want to play. However, I've heard from parents who say they don't want their son to play. One called recently on our program and said, explain to me why it's safe for my son to go back to campus and play football, but it's not safe for the average student. It's a fair comment. Another thing to consider, and you know, maybe for another day, but is college football the only sport that's going to be played? There's soccer and volleyball and other sports as well. So are we marching toward issues across the board?
Is it premature to ask what would happen to some of those college football stars' eligibility for the NFL draft?
Well, this came up a couple of weeks ago when everyone was trying to throw something up and see if it would stick. And the idea of if we couldn't get it in the fall, to try to start it in January or February. And that was immediately checked by saying, well, what would happen to the Stars? You think Trevor Lawrence of Clemson, who right now is projected as the number one player in what would presumably be next April's draft, you think he's going to play in March and April as opposed to getting ready to cash a $30 or $40 million check? I don't think so. I mean, it would be ridiculous.
Is there a moment on the calendar that you're looking to as sort of a deadline or a moment when we will have more clarity on all of this?
In essence, I think if the country moves along well in the next couple of weeks, I think sports will move along well, including college football. If there are setbacks, I think it will, the timetable and the calendars will be pushed back. But the one thing that I think college football has going for them right now in terms of the calendar is there's no set hard date. If on June 20th, there's still a little bit of mystery, they can say, we are going to table this for two or three more weeks, and with the idea of pushing the season back a little bit. So I think they keep pushing the season until they're faced with, we can't push this any longer.
Paul, you're on the radio every day talking about this, hearing from fans about this. And I imagine, as you've been saying, you know, the reaction is varied. Are emotions running hot on this issue? Do you find that you're getting a really strong reaction to some of these developments?
Emotions are running boiling hot right now, Mina. And I am concerned. I try to keep politics out of the program. I try to allow all sides to be heard, you know, starting with information from people. It's getting very emotional and very political. And it's extremely disturbing. I'm not being Pollyanna. I mean, I realize it's an even year. That's an election year. It's a presidential election. But I think people are still arguing, in the context of college football, mind you, the importance and the risk of the virus. I hear some of the same things today that I heard 10 weeks ago on why we should shut down. College presidents, college athletic directors are hearing the same thing, and I think they're very concerned about making a determination too quickly, especially one that is negative. I think you're hearing more optimism as a result of that. There's no one that wants college football more than me. My entire program is built on that in terms of an audience. But on the other hand, I do think we have to be careful. I think we have to be very mindful of the risk and the risks involved. And I know that the people in charge are taking all that into consideration. And I'll say they are fortunate, just like with Roger Goodell. They'll be able to see what happens in golf and in NASCAR, in Major League Baseball, and possibly with the NBA. So there will at least be some precedent before the critical final decision has to be made.
Thanks so much, Paul.
My pleasure, Mina. Always great to be with you.
Coming up, German football came back. So how many times can we say Bundesliga in one segment? Here's another story I want you to know.
Good news for football fans now. More than 2 months after its last official game, Germany's Bundesliga is back. Millions are expected to tune in to see the first major sports action in Europe since the coronavirus lockdown began.
Yes, it's true. The first of Europe's major sports leagues returned to action this weekend, with Germany's Bundesliga kicking off with a total of 9 matches. Joining me now to discuss the league's return is Gab Marcotti, who covers European soccer for ESPN. So, Gab, You're based in London, where soccer has yet to return. Why was Bundesliga able to come back now?
The reason they were able to come back first, certainly out of the European leagues, has to do with the fact that certainly the pandemic hit Germany less severely than it did other countries. Germany is also a wealthier country relative to its neighbors. And then really, above all, I think there's a lot of trust in the German government and in the German health service. And they were very confident. They came out. They spoke very clearly. They had a lot of public backing early on. And people believed that they could do it safely.
What were some of the precautions that they put in place?
What they've basically done is no fans in the stadium.
There's the empty stadium right in front of you. There's no atmosphere. There's no shouting, no screaming. I'm pretty sure there's a little bit outside. I haven't seen pictures yet, but that's strange. And then coming out...
A lot of testing. Tests are widely available in Germany, and people go back to their homes in between games and practice sessions, but they're tested very often. And then during the games themselves, just about everybody, except for the actual players on the pitch and the referee and the coach, if he's got to come close and shout at them, apart from those guys, pretty much everybody else is wearing masks and social distancing. So when you look to the bench, you're kind of struck by the fact that not just a bunch of dudes sitting on the bench, which you're used to, but they're all spaced out.
And you can see their sub's bench is, it's a long one. You wouldn't like to have to pass the salt down the table on a big spread out table like that. Dortmund.
The players are also supposed to avoid, hugging and jumping on each other. Although when Hertha Berlin won, they were seen embracing after all three of their goals, which I think drives home just how difficult it is to enforce all of this.
Yeah, I mean, look, the attitude they took is set an example, but we're not going to crack down overly. You know, if in the spontaneity of scoring a game-winning goal, there's contact, we can live with it. Because, look, it's a contact sport, right? Every time there's a corner kick or a free kick, these guys are all over each other. So there will be some amount of incidental contact. What they don't want is to create a situation where you act as if, you don't care about this stuff. And so in the situations where you can help it, they generally ask that you avoid contact and respect the social distancing.
What did the players have to do to get on the field in the first place? What sort of quarantining steps do they have to go through?
So in the end, it was a 7-day quarantine that they asked for. There was a lot of debate in different countries, which should be 7 days or 14 days. It was a 7-day quarantine. And as I mentioned, they underwent a lot of testing, or I guess antigen tests, as well as the corona test itself. They had a number of positive cases, which they expected. If you test positive, you're treated the way you might treat an injured player. You go away, and assuming you're asymptomatic, you go quarantine yourself somewhere else until you're clear. But everything else carries on. And that was really the way they tried to prepare themselves to come back in a context that would feel as normal as possible.
Well, I've just had a piece of big news reaching me. In fact, Giovanni Reina is not going to play from the start. I dare say that might have been something that Reina possibly pulled something in the warm-up. Yeah,
it seems like that. Gab, another reason why soccer fans in the U.S. were excited for Bundesliga's return was 17-year-old American phenom Giovanni Reina, who was expected to start for Borussia Dortmund, but unfortunately suffered an injury in warm-ups and ended up being a late scratch. How good is he expected to be?
Well, he's certainly drawn a ton of hype. I think he's actually played less than 200 minutes of league football this season. And yet he was due to make his first league start for Borussia Dortmund. He got hurt in the warm-up, as you mentioned. He's somebody who's got a lot of people excited. He's got a good pedigree. His dad, Claudio Reina, is a U.S. men's national team legend. He's quick. He can dribble. He's got an eye for goal. He's sort of an attacking midfielder, winger type. He's a very exciting player on a team that has, a lot of players that are sort of exciting and offensive minded. So he's surrounded by like-minded talent, which I think in some ways takes some of the pressure off him. He's still super, super young, and people need to remember that. But certainly you look at him and, he's probably the most exciting, young U.S. talent since Christian Pulisic 4 years ago.
Gab, do you think there's something to be learned from Bundesliga for the other leagues, or do you think Germany is such a unique situation that'll be hard to replicate?
I think there's a ton to be learned. I think other leagues are using the Bundesliga experience as this is a roadmap of how you do it. This is a sign that it can be done. You know, Germany does have a ton of advantages because it is a wealthier, better organized country that was hit less hard by the pandemic. And there's no denying that. But it gave people a ton of hope simply seeing, you know, these guys out there playing, even though obviously it was in surreal conditions and empty stadiums and guys with surgical masks on the bench. I think equally the stakes, though, are very high because nobody else is starting up until the middle of June at the earliest. And they're all watching and hoping that nothing goes wrong with Germany. Because there's a flip side to that too, which is if something goes horrendously wrong, if those hurt are players that you mentioned before embracing, if it turns out they all infected each other and all of a sudden that whole team needs to be quarantined or whatever, then you might take a step back and say, all right, this is out of the question. We're not starting up again. So in some ways, I think this is a test case, not just for the major European leagues, but, you know, probably for all of team sport to learn from this blueprint and see whether it can be applied elsewhere.
Thanks so much, Gab.
My pleasure.
I'm Ina Kimes, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.